All right, so why don't we get started? I'll introduce myself and the panelists briefly. So my name is Adam Glenn, and I'm on the faculty of the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, interactive or digital journalism prof, and a longtime SEJ member and editor of the SE Journal. Sarah Peach is on the faculty of University of North Carolina School of Communication.
School of Journalism and Mass Communication.
School of Journalism and Mass Communication. As a matter of fact, if you look, if you're in this document, you'll see the bios here as well, and links to the bios. Molly Samuel on the end there is producer at KQED Science. Both Sarah and Molly and myself have long experience in environmental journalism, but also more relevant today is to the some of the tools that take web and internet journalism to the next level. So what we're going to do today, this has been promoted as a workshop, and so we want to make it as much of a workshop as we can. It's not a traditional workshop in the sense we're not in a lab here, but welcome. Hats may stay on, it's okay. And so what we're going to try and do is first very briefly have Sarah and Molly talk and myself talk with you about these tools and their value. But then we're going to move into a more open discussion about examples of the kind of work that you might see. So that's when your mobile device will come in handy. So keep it out. All the links are on the this shared document and as well in a presentation. Are we going to use? No, we're not going to use that. We're going to use this. So all the links will be here. You can look at them on your phone with us or your tablet. Because I think we have the right number also for a discussion that might allow us, after we look at examples and talk together about some best practices, to maybe share some things that you're working on or want to work on in this area, and maybe we can't do it for everyone because it's a little too large for that. Come on in, Randy. But we can certainly hear from some folks who have ideas for concrete projects and want to know maybe how to use some of these tools. So we'll try to keep that workshop mode going. Most importantly, in any workshop, is the interaction. So let's not let this devolve into the three of us sitting here searching our, you know, tiny brains for interesting things to say. We have a few, which we'll share, but then let's really make it an open discussion. Yeah, this is the social, local, and mobile. So come on in and grab a seat. Sure, I'll put it back up on the screen, too. So it's bit.ly, bit.ly. /solomosej, so SOLOMOSEJ13, all lowercase. And I was joking with someone earlier that if we could think of a better phrase for social, local, and mobile than solomo, like, we'll get the prize, because that's the most embarrassing moniker probably possibly in the industry right now. Slow-mo is another possibility. Shlomo is more low. I don't know. Anyway, so work on that. If things get boring up here, just jot down. Slow mojo. Except we don't want slow mojo. Say it as slow mojo. Slow mojo. Slow mojo. Okay, jot it down. Patent it. Get your Twitter handle right away. Okay. All right, so let's move right into the substance of the panel. And again, some of this and the links particularly are here. But why don't we start with Sarah is going to talk about social.
Mobile.
Okay, already I'm in trouble. Molly is going to start by talking about social media. We're all familiar with more or less all three, so there'll be some overlap. But yeah. Molly's going to start us off with talking about social.
Social first. Okay. I assume on some, I mean, are any of you, I don't want to single anyone out, is anyone not using a social network, even personally? You know, is anyone not on Facebook looking at high school friends' children you didn't know existed until 2 years ago? I mean, we all kind of use it. And I'm not, like, a crazy social media evangelist. I'm not on Twitter all day. I check Facebook a couple times a week. I'm not like, I know some people think this is like the greatest thing ever. And I think it's fine. I think it's nice. And I'm happy to share experiences with you, but I'm not trying to like beat anyone over the head with, you really have to be on everything all the time. I think you'll go crazy. So the first thing I was going to show is if you, it should be just the first thing under my name on that list is, it's a Facebook page. The URL is not what the actual page is called, and sorry for the bad word. I fucking love science.
We should have warned people to leave first.
Yeah, if there's anyone who's not okay with not public radio friendly language, I'm sorry. So this page, I think it has over 7 million likes. This is a page that's managed by somebody in her free time. This is not somebody who works for a science publication. It's somebody who earnestly really likes science. And if you scroll down a little bit, you can kind of see examples. It's very, very visual. It's easy to take in the information, and most of it is just like, this is really cool. Like, here's a picture of something. Here's one sentence about it. It's awesome. And just, it's like this kind of just genuine enthusiasm for science. And I think environment reporting really lends itself well to this kind of thing. And I try to think about ways to share, you know, I stumble upon a cool map on the USGS website while doing some research. It's not part of a story yet. It's sort of a tool. Maybe it's not even a tool. Maybe I was just dawdling. But it's kind of a cool thing to be able to share, you know, post it on Twitter or Facebook. Hey, I just stumbled on this really cool map. And it's sort of, you know, it's an easy kind of thing to kind of, I think, to share enthusiasm. Funny, you know, here's a crazy animal I'm doing a story about. The story's not up yet, but, you know, it's sort of incremental, just here's one fact. And using sort of headlines and images are a really good way to do that. So that's, I think, one example of using Facebook. KQED Science, where I work, is the next link, and it's the Google Plus page. I don't really use Google Plus. I'm not the person who updates the Google Plus page, but we have we're a, you know, a local NPR affiliate, and, you know, more than 120,000 people are following this page. I didn't even know that many people were using Google Plus. I mean, but this is, I think there's something to be said here for just trying something early. You know, somebody in my department said, I'm kind of curious about Google Plus. I'm going to sign us up. So we ended up being very early adopters to this. And so that got a lot of engagement. And then just finding kind of where the people who are interested in what you're doing are. And Google Plus is we're the station that people in Silicon Valley listen to. The people who made Google Plus listened to us. So that ended up being a good social network for KQED, for KQED Science to be involved in. So I think that's another example of just, you know, it's okay to just kind of try one out. You know, see, there's a lot out there, and just kind of experiment and see where people are who will be kind of interested in what you're doing.
Just a quick question, Molly, and we'll look at some more examples too. But so is the main purpose of the social media experimentation at KQED to find audiences where they are and reach them, or is it to create new audiences?
It really depends on the platform. And the science department in KQED has sort of made a decision, partially just following the interests of the people who work in the department, to kind of be all over the place. And there are actually three of us managing various social media accounts for the organization. I know most places don't have resources like that. But I manage Twitter and am starting to use Instagram for the science unit. Somebody else is doing Google Plus, Tumblr, Pinterest, I don't know, and then somebody else is doing Facebook. So we have the benefit of being a large organization, and so we're using the different media in different ways.
So sort of the idea of finding the conversation where it is and going to
it's just being there. We're just, but I think I don't want it to be too overwhelming, and just because that's how KQED has decided to do it, I would say, I mean, kind of the most important thing is figure out one social network that, you know, if you have the resources to use one, figure out which one you like and which one you feel most natural using and use that one well. instead of spreading yourself really thin, instead of saying, I really need to post to Twitter now, and then I should do Facebook, and then I don't even know how to use Tumblr, but I should use it. Figure out something that feels social to you, that feels like you can participate in a conversation where it's happening and how it's happening, that feels like it's a good way to share your work, to share other people's work, to kind of engage and talk to people. And so I would, even though KQED has gone all over the place, part of that is because of the resources and that each of us working on a different media or medium are able to really engage reasonably on that one.
No, please, just say your name, if you would.
I'm Judy Case, from Salt Lake City. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you work with your web page and then social media? I'm seeing more and more people using, say, Facebook as, in effect, their blog page or their home page. And I'm not sure if that's just where I am or if that's sort of a...
Let me just repeat the question for the recording, but the degree to which social media can work with existing web platforms or be its own kind of standalone publication.
I think it really depends. I think you have to figure out where your audience is. And if you switch to just using Facebook, are you going to be losing people who don't want to use Facebook that way or who aren't on Facebook? One way that I use it, but it's sort of the opposite of that, is that we have a Twitter feed of KQED Science embedded on the Science News homepage. And so stories that none of us are reporting that aren't going to make it onto that homepage because it's ours, I'll make sure to tweet those headlines. And that way, at least if you're coming to our page, you're seeing that news, even though I'm just linking to the AP or linking to the San Francisco Chronicle. At least we're representing, hey, this news is happening. This is something that we think is valuable enough. And so I'm conscious of that when I'm tweeting on KQED Science, that's also appearing on our homepage. And so that's sort of like sort of in the opposite direction. And I think you can probably, I imagine you can do that with Facebook or with any of them, that maybe it's easier to be publishing on Facebook, but it could still be appearing somewhere else too.
Yeah, let's keep going, and sure. Then we'll come back and circle back to the mobile and geolocation component, but please.
Okay, so you said this.
Just say your name.
Jim Ruggers, Courier Journal, Louisville.
Thanks.
So there's these three or four different platforms that your news organization uses. Do each of them have kind of, do you understand, have you figured out that the audience is different from one to the other? And do you tailor what you post? Is it different what you put on Facebook versus Google Plus versus whatever, or is it all?
It is different.
Let me just repeat the question. To what extent are you tailoring the material for the audience on different platforms?
Yeah. It is different, and that's why I would really advocate for just figuring out one or maybe one or two that you're really comfortable with using and that you can kind of use the way people use them. I mean, sort of an extreme example is Pinterest, which is mostly a site that people use to post pictures of things that they like. It's almost like a shopping list kind of site. It's clothes, it's fashion, it's food, it's like home decorating. You know, KQED Science, I don't actually even know what we have up there because I don't really use Pinterest, but I think it's like, that's a good place to be posting cool pictures of places. It's totally visual. There's no... there's barely any words. And so not every news article needs to be there. I use Twitter the most, and that's sort of a mix. And so, I mean, I think that's why I would say to just sort of figure out how people are using one site and figure out how to kind of cater to that. You can post on Twitter, I think, much more frequently than on Facebook and not annoy people. On Facebook, if you're posting multiple times a day, just news headlines, you may be losing people. But on Twitter, that's like the way people are using it, or one of the ways.
So let's one more question, and then I think we'll go to the other two quickly, and then we'll open it right back up. So keep thinking. Question wise, Joe.
Google Plus. I mostly think of it as something for Hangouts, but obviously you're using it for much more than that, including almost like a web page or a news feed, and then got embedded tweets in there. I thought I saw, or something.
Yeah.
Could you quickly describe some of the major capabilities of Google Plus and what it does for you.
I unfortunately...
So, sorry, I apologize.
Oh, all right.
Let me just repeat the question, that just the characteristics or functions of Google+, please.
And I'm going to be totally useless to answer that question. I'm sorry, I don't use it. But if anybody, yeah, if either of you or if anybody else in the audience...
Somebody did that program.
I know, it wasn't, it's one of my colleagues. I'm not the person who updates the Google+ page.
You've got to have a
page.
Google account to get there.
Yes.
Yeah, and you have to also be logged into Google Plus as well.
Okay,
yeah.
Another layer.
Not right. Let's do this. And they're the great questions, so I don't want to stifle that at all. But let's hear briefly from Sarah on mobile. I'll talk briefly about geolocation, and then we'll open it back up and look at some more of Molly and Sarah's examples. I have a few, and just continued questions. So, please, Sarah.
Okay, so like Adam said, I teach at the University of North Carolina, and so since I'm a teacher, I brought a quiz for all of you. So the first question is, and just shout out answers, how many Americans have a cell phone, do you think?
200,000.
Okay, yeah, put it, what about in percent?
79%,
I heard. 80%? Okay. So let me give you the answer. This is according to a Pew Internet and Public Life survey done last April and May, and it's of American adults, and they found 91% of American adults have a cell phone. All right, raise your hand if you have a smartphone. Okay, a lot of you.
Smart.
Pretty smart.
Right.
So that'll give you a clue to the next question. How many American adults have a smartphone?
60%.
60%, I heard. You're close. It's 56%, according to the same survey. All right, and here's my favorite statistic. How many Americans now are going online using their phones more than they go online with their laptops or traditional desktop computers?
That's percentage compared to the total population or the population of people who go online?
Total population.
He probably knows the answer.
It's his research, bro.
Okay, I heard more than half, 40%, 60%. It's actually a little bit lower, although my statistic is old. It's from April of 2012, so it's probably higher than this. It's about 1 in 5 Americans are now going online more with their phones than with a computer. So that's why I'm really interested in mobile devices as a platform for news. And so I work at this in this lab at the University of North Carolina called the Reese News Lab. Which is a place where we test new ideas for the media industry. And so we started to think about mobile devices and how that was affecting the news industry, and we're worried that the news media is falling behind with the rise of these devices, kind of in a similar way that we fell behind with the rise of the Internet. So we decided to do an experiment. So we took 10 of our students for 12 weeks, and we had them build a mobile-first news website. And so we had them basically reverse the process that I think a lot of us tend to use when we're producing the news, where we write something for the newspaper. It probably gets up on the website. Probably most of us have a news website now for our organizations. And then it sort of gets pushed out to the mobile device, but without a lot of thought behind it. And that's if we're lucky. We have a mobile version of our news website. So we told students, flip that around. Your primary consumer is someone with a phone. Don't worry about the computer. Don't worry about a print product. To create something that would be perfect for someone consuming it on a device that's this big. And so we had them do this for 12 weeks and figure out some best practices of how you go about doing that, what's really serving mobile news consumers. And then the students and I put together an ebook of best practices. And so I'll be sharing some examples of the work that the students did and talking about what we learned from that experiment. Yes.
What's the name of it?
It's called News on the Go. You can get it from reesenewslab.org.
So I'll pick up on this quickly, and then let's get back to this is some of the same sources here. The number of people with smartphones using location-based services, 3/4. This is Pew, May 2012. And 1 in 5 are using the to check in locations and share locations with friends, but 74%. And then a third are also yet using the service to tag their updates. So as they create information and news, they're giving a location to that information as well, all of which is something that we as journalists can use. Now, when I come back to talk about some examples, which I'll cut short for a moment now, you know, most people talk about Foursquare. I have a bunch on Foursquare. It's been around for several years. A lot of news organizations have used Foursquare. It's basically a check-in, a social check-in service, and, you know, it's become famous for making people the mayor of, you know, the northeast corner of 36th and 3rd or whatever it might be, and people fight for that privilege. But what I want to point out is that geolocation is really now increasingly being essentially baked into all kinds of new, especially apps, because of the mobile nature of geolocation. But it's being built into all kinds of other things, whether it's travel or services that provide recommendation engines. I have a list, you know, here you can kind of look through, and a lot of links as well, mapping service, other kinds of tools. And so I want you to think about that. When we think about social, mobile, and local together, think about them being married into each app. Geolocation is not something that's separate, but is part of everything you do, whether it's taking a picture, which now has geo information attached, embedded in the metadata of the picture. And I'll show you some examples of how that can be used. But let's, having just set that stage in a rather convoluted way, let's go back to either any questions or to look at some more examples, either from Molly on social, from Sarah on the mobile side. But any questions before we do that? Yeah. And Cheryl.
This geolocation thing, I've been reading recently that a lot of young people have turned this geolocation stuff off, and then some of us old codgers and newly Fourth Amendment people, as well as First Amendment people, we turn it off too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about that, how that affects this information, and how do you use this information?
So just to repeat the question, to what extent are especially younger demographics not using, deliberately closing off geolocation tags, and even if the information is there, how do you use it? So, I think that there's an interesting sort of backlash, to some extent, I think, related to the whole much larger debate about privacy and the degree to which social media, and we can talk about this more, open us up in ways that we're not comfortable with. And I think my assumption is that young people are turning it off because they know how. And most of the rest of us don't even realize that we can do that or that it's happening. So maybe once we do, we turn it off if we have concerns about privacy. I mean, there are tools which are deliberately meant to track people, you know, geofencing and geotracking, and, you know, parents will give their kids a phone only if the child or teenager keeps the geolocation on, so they know that when they say they're sleeping over at Susie's, they're actually at a party down on 14th Street.
Sleeping over at Bobby's.
At Bobby's, right, that's right. Or the reverse, that's right, yeah, exactly. So there are tools that deliberately use that. To answer the question, though, about journalistic uses, I mean, this has been one of the challenges, I think, for Foursquare. I'll show you a couple of examples that I have, and this is all in this document. You can peek around at these. But, for example, the Wall Street Journal uses Foursquare, let me open this up, basically as a tip service for restaurants and other kinds of things that its readers might be interested in. So sort of, you know, a great steak at such and such a place, or here's a new place for possibly overpriced lobster, whatever it might be. So there are tips that Wall Street Journal itself is providing that are on Foursquare, so that people using Foursquare can find this information. So that's one example. It's often said, although less clear how many examples there are, that you can use a service like Foursquare to identify people who are at the scene of breaking news. So you can actually find, you know, and this was cited in, there was a bomb scare in Times Square in the spring of 2012, and some news organizations found people who were there, as well as alerting some of the thousands of people who were there that this was going on by focusing in geographically. However, some of the links I've shared with you seem to indicate that, you know, that really hasn't panned out. That's kind of breaking news angle in the way it was thought. And maybe you guys have, I'm not sure if you're doing any Foursquare work, but that feature, sort of evergreen use, things like reviews and tips, sort of opinions in that sense, recommendations seem to be more fitting. You know, one news executive said, you know, in the middle, if you're looking at Foursquare and I'm the mayor of Bryant Park and here's a nice restaurant, all of a sudden there's breaking news, it can be a jarring experience. So their feeling is it doesn't really work for that. But there are many other examples of where it does work. So I'll just point you to them. I mentioned some, and then I have a couple of, like, finding a source with a specific location. But then I also included links here on other ways you can use it. But this is mostly perspective. This really hasn't happened. And I think what will make the difference, just to tie a bow on it, is as geolocation tools are increasingly part of every other app, we will find ways. And I'll show you one example. And by the way, all of these links you can look at on your phones, although I noticed this one didn't show the map in the same way. So this is a CNN reporter who followed the tornadoes in Oklahoma last spring by basically, and it will load eventually, by basically traveling the 17-mile path of the tornado, and in each location tagging images and other reporting. I'm sorry, it's not loading. But when it does, you'll see that there's a map that shows this long line that the tornado traveled. And there's a lot of text connected with it. And as you scroll down the text, it brings up the point on the map and the image that he took at that specific location. So it's a way of tying the geography to the story in a clever way, which apparently we're not going to see up here.
That
I don't know. I assume, well, CNN, I'm not sure what they're using. It's a proprietary content management system, but I don't think, I think they probably created something on their own, which most of us couldn't do, to display it at least. But to tag the information, you could conceivably do this on a Google map, and we can talk about mapping finally, but it's not going to load properly, it doesn't look like. So I'll try it again. We'll let it do its thing. But let's other questions, and then we'll hear some other examples too. Okay. You want to share a couple of examples?
Sure. I think Joe has a question.
Oh, Joe. Oh, here it is. Sorry. There you go. Okay. So there's the path of the tornado, and what happens is as you work your way down the text, which it also, yeah, there we go. It starts to, you can see a dot in the far left lower corner, and then the image changes. And then as I move along to the next element, it adds another dot and a new image. And basically as you move along, you can see dots start to populate the map and images arise.
And that's embedded Twitter too.
Yeah, exactly. These are the tweets.
Is the geolocation information actually in the TwitterPix?
Yes, that's how they identified it. So and you could do that. That's a very straightforward thing to do with most cameras. Digital cameras now will allow you to do that, or many of them anyway.
What's the interplay with Twitter on that?
So what's happening? It's a little hard to see, but as I move down the text, it brings up a little dot here, right, and then simultaneously displays the Twitter picture, the picture that was taken in that specific location.
I thought Twitter, like Facebook and maybe someplace else, stripped out the metadata or whatever from their photos, so when you post it, people can't find your kid's name in your bag.
Yeah, that's a scary thought, isn't it, for all us parents?
I thought Twitter said that they were getting, if you put a photo on Twitter, you can't do that.
So this says, he indicates, I don't know much about the project, but he indicates, Sean Sutter is the columnist, he said that he tracked his path by GPS, So it's possible, maybe probable, based on what you're saying, that he then basically tagged these himself in post-production after the fact.
You can also, I think you can turn location on and off on Twitter. You can choose whether your tweets are in a place
or not. And Facebook, for that matter, I think you can. I know with Facebook you can turn it on and off as well. Sarah's going to share some mobile examples for us, too. And then
sure. So if we can go back to that handout.
Yeah.
As a general matter, you can embed Twitter feeds onto pretty much any web page.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very easy to put a Twitter feed. Absolutely.
Okay, so if you have your phone with you, this is a really good chance to take a look at what these sites look like on your phone, because we can pull them up here, but it's going to look a little different on this screen.
So is this the first one?
Yes.
Okay.
So while this is coming up, this is Evening Edition. It's a mobile news service that's designed for commuters. It comes out every day at 5 o'clock, and it just gives you a quick summary of the biggest news of the day. So you can imagine being on the train, riding home, and you can spend 2 or 3 minutes finding out the most important things that you missed. So it's really simple, especially on your phone. I think it looks just really nice and clean. And I think it's a great example of something that serves a specific purpose for the audience. I think the common theme in my examples is that they're personal, and they're really, the people who made them have really thought about what their audience is going to be doing with them on the phone.
So who makes them?
This is some folks in California.
It's a design company in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So it's called San Francisco News?
You can choose your
site. Yeah, so we have a few different, they have a few different locations, Cairo, London.
Who wants to go to Paris?
Yeah.
No?
They make money.
Yeah, that's a good question, because they don't run ads.
It's a for-profit design company, and this is like a side project.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But I think it's a... Finances aside, it's a really good example of a specific purpose you can do to serve a mobile audience in this way.
So they're marketing their company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's worth funding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who does the reporting?
So they have some. The question was, who does the reporting? They have some editors in these different locations, and in a sense, they're aggregating the news and curating it. I don't think there's a lot of original reporting. It's more of a here's what you missed kind of service. Okay.
So, yeah. Did you want to also, as the fact that it's responsive design of interest?
Yeah. So, if you actually, you can show that if you drag at the corner of the page. Yeah, that's more, this is more what it looks like on a phone.
So, this is sort of a minimal, right? This idea of what's called responsive design, even if you're not designing directly for mobile, at this idea that responsive design fits the screen that it's being viewed on. It's responsive to the screen size. So you can sort of always test that out by dragging and moving it around. You see that it adjusts for each screen size, including your phone or tablet.
Okay, so my second example is it's an app, actually, so we won't get to look at it the way it is going to appear on your phone, but you can go ahead and download it on your phone if you like. So this is NPR's mobile news app. And what I think is really interesting about this example is that this is how my students are getting their news. They tell me they have this app on their phone. In the morning when they get up, they choose which news they want to listen to and load it up on the playlist of this app, because that's what it allows you to do. You don't have to listen to the radio as it's delivering whatever news those editors have chosen for you. You can pick and choose through different news stories, pick out what you want to listen to, load the playlist, and then they walk across campus and are listening to the news that way. So what I really like about that app is it's taking advantage of everybody now has a radio in their pocket. And it, again, like Evening Edition, it's they've really thought about what this particular audience is going to want, and that personalization of the news.
Okay.
Did you call it personalization?
Personalization.
That was the other topic we were talking about before, the personalization. Could you state your name?
Oh, Louise Lee.
Okay.
Just a philosophical question on this whole issue of personalization of communities. If that perceives people are getting what they want, but has communities have new information that they may not know about, penetrate that personalized universe that you've created, and isn't that potentially a problem if people are going deeper into the areas they already know, but closing themselves off to potentially new interesting areas that they haven't been exposed
to? So just to repeat the question, does personalization preclude serendipity, I guess, really, in finding news people don't know, already know they want to see?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question. And it's certainly worth thinking through. The people who have this app are presented with all of the news of the day, so they can at least see the headlines and know they might have some awareness of an issue that's happening, even if they don't choose to listen to that story. But in a sense, it's not that different from having a newspaper. I think most people don't read every single story that's in the newspaper. They pick and choose.
Also, just to add to that, too, one of the things about social media is that it does allow you to be exposed to news you might not otherwise find by virtue of your connection to your network. I mean, how many folks in here have gotten news first off of Facebook, someone sharing something? You know, maybe a third, half of the rooms. That's a good example. Now, you have to choose your friends correctly, right? which is a problem for all of us, I think. But that is the point. And in a sense, what's the difference there than just having an editor, an abstract, anonymous editor, decide what your news will be? Is that really serendipity anyway?
Judy? We were having a little discussion before your session about video, and how big a deal is that, and how much do all of you feel like that ought to be part of all of the different platforms you're talking about?
So the question is video on mobile, I guess, essentially, yeah.
Well, I can speak to that based on the experiences that my students went through. Our videographers and photographers had a really hard time. Because the product is going to be this big, and it drove them crazy. They went out and collected beautiful footage, these little detail shots of a cloud just moving a little bit, or a fly buzzing around. And on the screen size, you can't even see it. It looks like it's just a still shot.
And I think, you know, we produce video specifically for online. I mean, we're also a TV station, so there's TV being produced at KQED, but there's also online-specific video. And I think the perception is that people like video, but I have to imagine, and this is something that as a radio producer I have to admit to myself, people sitting in their offices, which is how a lot of people are looking at stuff online, and like that's when you're dawdling on Facebook, right, is at work. If you don't already have your headphones plugged into your computer, are you going to go through the trouble of plugging in your headphones to listen to something or to watch something? Maybe not. I mean, I think if you're choosing what visual medium to focus on, I would be inclined to go more towards photography.
And just to add to that, in terms of the importance of video generally, I mean, there was a stat I saw the other day that every minute, 100 hours of video is uploaded to YouTube. So every minute, 100 hours. And what that speaks to, of course, you know, people are producing that. Ordinary folks are creating that video, and all kinds of other professionals as well, that there's a huge appetite to consume it as well as to create it. And any news organization that's not thinking about video, and particularly video on the phone, is going to miss that enormous energy. But, you know, I think the New York Times, for instance, their video, it's not traditionally a video operation, obviously, but their video, they are producing a lot of video, but a lot of it is sort of talking head type stuff, which can easily be seen and appreciated on this smaller screen. So, yeah.
We all probably work at, there's a lot of us that work at news organizations that the business side feels that they can sell video. So how do we go and choose what video works best for the platform and what kind of videos to do, and how does the videos help provide something extra for our readers? As opposed, because I mean we're going to have to do it. So how do we choose to do it in a way that makes it most sense?
So just the best video for the medium. You know, how do we decide that?
I would. What I try to do when I there's you know some reason for me to do video is assuming that I don't have vast resources of editors and producers is you know if I'm out there getting a scene anyway there's somebody telling me how something works explaining something to me try to get like you know a 30 second shot of them doing that again but on the video you know say can you explain to me again what's going on with this stream. And just that's something you don't have to edit, hopefully, if they do it well. You know, just get 30 seconds and embed that, and that might do it for you.
There was a question here.
Requiring reporters to do tallies, which are, what, 6 seconds?
Yeah.
What is that?
Yes. So for folks that aren't familiar, there are video sort of sharing sites like a Vine, which has a limit of 6 seconds, and what the Instagram video is 15
yeah.
seconds. There's a question here and then back there.
I think to a certain extent, video is kind of like what you were saying on social media, where there's certain audiences you really yeah. only get through video. So just as some people get their news through their Twitter feed and others through their Facebook feed, some people get it through their YouTube feed. So I think part of this is think maybe there's people who just prefer video and that's how they're going to consume most of their content.
Yeah, please.
Hi, Scott from Cleveland. Is anybody, are you guys teaching at all, or is any other organization starting to use video? As bad of a name as this app is, because it sounds ridiculous. Videolicious on iPhone?
I don't know.
Anybody? Okay. I started using it, I just left the idea a few months ago, but started using it there. It's a tremendous app because it allows you to pick still shots and video, the free version, still shots and video up to a minute in length. And up to 10 different, still or video. It weaves them together. You can narrate it. You can actually tell a story as opposed to a 6-second video, which is, I just wonder because it just seems to sort of be coming up now. And the paper in Cleveland, it's not a digital organization there, just purchased a contract where now at the end of it, instead of saying Videolicious, which is ridiculous, it says Cleveland.com or something to that effect. You know, so it's not
right.
A bad app. I wonder. If
yeah, and it's all on the phone.
Yeah.
Cool.
There's a free version, all the way up to 1 minute and 10 still shot videos.
And Mark, you've used it?
Yeah. But it's really, really simple. Yeah. You can make one. I mean, you can really tell a story.
How all the advanced websites are doing are using Videolicious and bought that access. And you can add music.
Yes. Well, music's a little
boring. Yeah, it is.
PR, but instead of you can narrate it if you wish, or you can let the video do the talking. Now, the problem is if you shoot a 30-second video, you as you're telling the story by tapping on your camera roll, which ones you want, when you've seen about 6 seconds of the video, you just tap the next image and it cuts it off.
One of the things I think, just to point out about this, because we've been talking a lot about consuming news on these phones, but one of the points here is that you can you're creating it there as well, and that goes to the huge volume of information that's flooding now, not just video, but all kinds of other things, because everybody's walking around with a smartphone or a feature phone and can create this content directly. Yeah.
One of the questions, I mean, you said this was an iPhone app, and I don't know if it's also for the rest of us, because actually there are more Android owners than there are iPhone owners.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I can't tell from looking at this. Did you guys have any comment on this one? No? Video apps?
I'm going to go home and try it.
One more example?
Yeah, please. Okay. Let's go back. So we're going to take a look at just one more example from Sarah.
Yeah. Okay, so this is I want to show one more example. This is the How Screwed Are You College Debt Calculator. So this is something that my students created. It's aimed at a college audience, and the idea was let's take a look at college debt, but in a way that's going to be friendly to mobile phone users. So here's the calculator, and we can actually walk through it. So it asks you how much money you've taken out in student loans, let's say $30,000. How many years I'm going to take to pay it off, we can leave it at 10. And then the interest rate on my loans, let's say I got a great interest rate of 3%. Okay, so then it actually, it, if you scroll down, it shows you the amount of PBRs you could buy with that amount of money. So, and
each one is 100 cans, by the way, in case you can't read that.
And you can see the number of ramen noodles as well.
Oh, ramen? Oh, yeah, you can look at it in ramen noodles.
Yeah.
That's 100 bags, and yeah, that's a lot of ramen. Ramen and PBR for years.
Okay. Yes.
Wow, it goes on and on and on. Oh, Lord, I'm getting... Stop! Okay.
So if you scroll back up, I'll show you why this is mobile-friendly, other than being appealing to college students. So... what the students did to, as they thought about programming this this tool, was they thought, okay, what's one of the things we hate the most when we're on our phone? And that's typing all with using all those little keys. So that's why they made these drop-down boxes. Right. And also, on the if you're switching between the PBR and the ROM and the toilet paper and cookout trays, you don't have to, you can just tap that with your phone. So they just... It's just a little detail, but they were really thinking about somebody's going to use this on my phone, on a phone. How? What's the best way to do it? And this ended up being one of our most popular features.
That's a great one, and I think
that's friendly is good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting thing. I mean, I've heard of mobile experts talking about the kind of the language of your hands, gesture language that will emerge. You know, we're already starting to see some things that we wouldn't think to do, you know, squeezing and pinching and so on. I mean, they're natural behaviors, but they're going to become that much more so, you know, as we've all devices become touch, including our laptops and other tablets become touch sensitive. So other questions? And I think I know Molly had some more examples too of good strong projects with social. Should we take a look at any others?
Yeah, so another, I was going to... One more I wanted to show is that, you know, it's not... You can use social not just to share your work or to find other people's work, but also to for reporting. And so there's this... The NPR Facebook example was just last week.
Oh, sure. I'll go in the long link, that one.
Yeah, where they did a call out on Facebook, how are you going to be affected by government shutdown? And they got... When I checked, when I posted this link to this document, it was they had gotten more than 700 responses on Facebook. They also posted it on Twitter, and people, and as you scroll down through that story, you can see that they wove people's responses into the story. I mean, the same as you would do like a man on the street interview, but they did this, you know, and were able to reach people all around the country with their responses. And they also in the radio version of the story, I think they also had people calling in and leaving messages, and so that they were able to also play audio from that resulted from this call out. So, you know, it's a way to find, to reach people that you wouldn't necessarily run into if you went and stood next to the nearest Safeway, which is how I get my Vox Pop when I have to do it.
Nice example. Question, yeah? Could you state your name?
Yeah, Dan Grossman. I may be misunderstanding something here, but the one thing that struck me as you were describing that is, of course, this is the same problem with Vox Pop, but usually Vox Pop is just a limited part of the story. You just throw that in there. And whenever I hear that in story, I think, well, they could have gotten whatever they want. You interview enough people, you get whatever you want, you just filter it out and decide what you wanted. With this, there's no filter. You have no idea whether this is made up or bona fide. And there could be 100 people who decided they were all going to be making up bizarre stories or whatever, and it just it doesn't matter if it's one story or a few stories. But if this ends up being, you know, what we're consuming, then is, you know, you're worried about that being a dangerous kind of source of information.
I'm not sure I was...
Just repeat the question. Oh, yeah. How well can you vet the quality of crowdsourced information on a platform like Facebook to use in news?
Well, one thing with Facebook is that it's impossible to be anonymous on Facebook, right? If you're commenting on NPR's Facebook page, it's your picture and your first and last name attached to it. It's significantly less anonymous than, like, comments on a newspaper article.
That said, people could still totally be making up their responses, but that's the same with Vox Pop, you know, actual man on the street. Mm-hmm. They could, I hope they're not doing that, but you know, it could be made up. So, but right, I mean, it's the internet is a wide world.
But there are two also, I think, maybe to clarify this, it looks like on one hand, there's the Facebook page where they're soliciting the comments, and then the Facebook page has everything unfiltered, in a sense. But then also, they're using presumably standard journalistic practice as they then take some of those and use them within this story. So there's some kind of normal vetting process as they incorporate them here. And I don't know what that is. I don't know what NPR is doing, but maybe they're contacting the person, checking to see if they're where they say they're from, et cetera. So there is that distinction. There's this sort of Wild West of the platform itself, like Facebook, and then there's the news product that results, which can go through vetting. Was there another question back there? Oh, yeah, please. Oh, okay. All right, good. Yeah, please.
I was wondering,
just state your name, by the way.
Harrison Reeves.
Okay.
From Nashville. I was wondering, I see a lot of times on Twitter interactions between journalists, a lot of times even journalists who might never interact normally and they're not the same outlets. Have you seen any interesting stories come out of that? Does that have an effect on reporting and journalism, or is that just kind of people having fun?
So, a journalist talking to journalists using social media?
Yeah. Tips or stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, journalists collegially, hopefully, sharing information and insights like SUJers do all the time, but on social media.
I see people maybe more or less collegially criticizing work all the time. What's interesting about Twitter is that then the person who's being criticized can respond right back and say, here's why I did it this way, or, you know, what's your problem, or what, you know, you can, it's, and that, I can't think of any examples off the top of my head necessarily, but that, I think that, you know, there's an exchange of ideas happening all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Rosen.
Oh, right.
Anybody
yeah.
Yeah. Two examples. One is that the newspaper war in New Orleans is being waged in part by Twitter amongst the reporters. All of the media in town. The other is, as I was sitting in the VP trial on Monday, I'm sorry, I'm Mark Schlesky, NOLA.com, sitting in the VP trial on Monday, tweeting the trial line by line. And the stuff going up on our, we built a page on our website where the tweets would automatically show up on the page and to drive stuff. And next to me was the Financial Times reporter reading my tweets on Twitter and retweeting them.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, he's giving credit.
And I had been doing the same thing at times during the day. When I was not in the courtroom trying to figure out who else was doing things. And there were also nonprofits in the courtroom also tweeting. Federal court.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Well, it's certainly one of the more sort of beautiful things about social media in that regard, and the what's usually referred to as the link economy overall, this idea that the work that you do is constantly referring to work that others have done, whether at your own news organization or even your own work, but other, within your news organization or outside of it. And one of the, I think, the great milestones a couple of years ago, the New York Times started on their front page, in areas of their front page, linking out to other news organizations reporting on things. There's a wonderful little sort of mechanism in Twitter where, it, like a retweet, but rather than retweeting, you share some information that came from another source, and you give a, you might have seen a little HT, a little hat tip. We have a hat in the room. That's a very, you know, that's a very nice and kind of a polite gesture. Now, it's not always done as it should be, but it often is, and reflects that concept. Andrew Sullivan talks about this with blogging. He says that, you know, it's like you're bobbing on the surface of an ocean, but anchored very deeply. And there are all kinds of things that are below the surface that you're constantly referring to, other reporters' work and other primary source material.
Sarah Shipley Howes at University of Missouri. One thing we've been having fun with lately is Rebel Mouse. Mm-hmm. You guys use Rebel Mouse?
Yeah.
So it's like a social curation aggregation tool, and you can set it up to pull in things using a certain hashtag or certain staff members or certain people that you want to follow. And we tend to use it for event coverage. But you can use it for a lot of different things.
What's your URL? I'll pull it up.
So it's really fun. You can embed this into your homepage or somehow put it on your blog or website. So just for example, we have a big blues music festival, and we used Rebel Mouse as a way to kind of curate what people were tweeting and Facebooking about the festival. Our staff, who was out there covering it, but in addition, what the public was saying. And people love it.
Nice.
Because once... if you put their tweet or Facebook post or their Instagram picture or whatever on your page and you let them know that it's there, it becomes a really fun way for the community to be like, hey, you know, this is being curated live and updated live, which is really fun.
Do you have a URL? I can put it up here if you like. Can you think of it?
I would have to search for rebelmouse.com.
No, I mean for her project. I can use, because I do use it, I'll put up, forgive the self-aggrandizing.
This is automatically curated.
Yep. So,
let's say that there was an SUJ 2013 Rebel Mouse stream that was set up. It would automatically, in fact, we should be doing that. It would automatically, on a page, be updating everything that everybody was tweeting using that hashtag. And you can set it up, like if you're concerned about content going up that you don't want, you can have, okay, these people are trusted users, and their content will automatically be posted, and then other people can go into a draft folder, and then you can manually post it. But it's just a really fun tool for things where there's people out there talking, and there's already a conversation going on about something.
So I pulled this up, not to be a jerk, because it's my project, but to show you... So this is a site that essentially curates discussion about climate adaptation in New York City, but there are many days where, because it's essentially a one-man operation, where I don't have either original content or deeper curation, so I just pull this black area is a Rebel Mouse module, and it basically just pulls up all my curation, you know, and that's the heart of the site. You know, there's other content below, and then when I have time to create other kinds of content, it goes on top of this, and this goes into the sidebar.
It's just a shot. So it can be a component in building a broader, larger site.
Right. It doesn't have to take it over. I can move this onto the side when I have other kinds of content, but otherwise it can be my front page, in effect. This is manual. I select these manually, but as Sarah's saying, you can create an automated feed. Yeah.
I saw also an agency, another college, they were using that as a secondary option. Or when their website goes down for any reason, because they were going to have a different storm and things like that. So you just jump on Rebel Mouse, and they would have all these tweeters, and tweeters would
tweet
from streets.
Just curious, by the way, how many folks in the room have heard of Storify? So most of how many have used it? So half the room or more has heard of it, and then three or four folks have used it. So we were talking earlier about curation, and I think the person asked or made a face when we talked about curation, which I'll tell her we brought it up again. But there's an example like this, too, where Storify allows you to just add value. It's not just taking somebody else's work and reflecting it. It's putting into context, adding your own context to it as well. Yeah, I'll put up an example. I don't have any particular example, but they usually put examples on their front page.
I wish to state that maybe 5 years ago the word curation was a dirty word in some people's mind. But I would assert now that it's an important branch of real journalism. Mm-hmm. That we, you know, it's no worse than the word editor.
Right. Yeah. So this is an example of a Storify from CNBC about the Twitter IPO. And the, one of the things that you will see immediately when you look at a tool like Storify is that, unlike Twitter, which is in reverse order, reverse chronology, Storify allows you to put it into the normal narrative order. And then at the same time allows you to add these little text blocks as well. So some of this is a tweet, this image and text in the middle, but the text above it is an editor's text. Someone wrote that to give it context, you know, and there's more context followed by the tweets, et cetera, et cetera. So just an interesting tool and a way to collect a story off of social media reporting. Other examples, or actually, we also have in the shared document, we also have some best practices that we suggest, and maybe we have, we have about 5-10 minutes. We can share some of those, and then see if there are any remaining questions.
Sure.
Either you guys want some? Okay.
Yes, I know a lot of people in the room are probably writers, and you can go on the document and see a list of best practices that I've put in there, but I just wanted to share one example of something we learned from doing our experiment, which was we suspected when we started the project that people using mobile devices wouldn't want to scroll a lot because their thumbs would get tired or whatever, or maybe they were standing in the grocery line and only had 10 seconds to look at a story. So we assumed that people would want shorter stories. So we set up some analytics on the site to track visitors who were reading our stories, and we could tell how far down in a story they were scrolling and which devices they were using. And to our surprise, we actually found that mobile users were scrolling just as far, so they had about the same rate of completion of a story as our desktop users. So that was something really interesting, and I think the takeaway is don't necessarily be afraid to write long for someone who's going to be reading on a phone.
That's encouraging. And certainly longer text on tablets has really seen a revival, right? Because people, are very comfortable reading even, book-length material. So that's good news. So there's a segment there on the shared document about writing. Any other anything, Molly, that you wanted to share?
I think that I mentioned most of the things that I have listed here. The only other thing I'd say is that if you are using Twitter a lot, what I use is Hootsuite to help manage it, which is actually a little buggy, but it's okay.
Has anybody in here using a third-party application like Hootsuite or TweetDeck?
So
if you haven't, I happen to have mine open, but so just an example of how you can organize many, many feeds into tabs and streams and so on. Make this a little smaller, you can see. So, 10, 20 tabs. Each tab might have, up to 10 streams, I think, something like that. So it allows you to, coordinate your use, right? So if I want to look just at SEJ stories today, I have my SEJ tab. If I want to look at stories about India or music or whatever it might be, I can just go to that tab and zero in. So highly recommended. You can also tweet, share post to various media, so not just Twitter, but I can post to Facebook or LinkedIn. I can also post to different clients. Like I happen to work with a number of different projects. I can post for each project. So you could do that if you have multiple channels at your news organization. You can post for that particular channel, whether it's maybe there's a science vertical or maybe you're just posting to general news, etc. One of the other things that I wanted to mention too is that we've shared a lot of tools and ideas, and sometimes it's easier to kind of forget the obvious things. Like one of the things that I often think about is geolocation. Well, maps and mapping, and we looked at a very sophisticated map, the CNN thing with the tweets, but you can just use, and the links are in here. You could just use simple map building sites like Google Maps and My Places on Google Maps to create custom maps, it's very easy to do. And we have, I think, you've done some mapping. We have someone in here who does some mapping.
Yeah, I'm really new with the Folger Center, and we use Mapbox, which is a free
well, it's free for a certain amount of use, and then once you get a pass, you have to choose how much you want to pay. But it's a really great site. It's like using Google Maps. You can create your own map on Google Maps really easily. But with Mapbox, you can personalize it more, so you can use colors, you can up saturation, you can use JavaScript to create different
Oh, okay, let's take a look. What is it?
Roadkill.
Oh, rose like the flower? Roadkill. It is roadkill.
With an S after the rose and then map after.
Oops, sorry. Roads kill, like plural road.
And roadkill map.
Map, like that?
In the URL.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, map. Roadkillmap.com. Okay.
So what we found now with our mobile, we've been changing everything to responsive design. And so now this is a responsive site, and it's also embeddable and shareable. So you can personalize it. You can zoom in. Those blue dots are stories. So this is now, we're trying to make like maps that tell stories. So Mapbox is a really good tool for that. This is done with JavaScript and Mapbox, but you can create really great maps with Mapbox without JavaScript. So if you don't know how to do that, you don't have to worry about that. But we've really been enjoying this.
Yeah.
Another tool you can use is Creativist, which is it's an A, it's an I. It's out of this new beta platform to be
like that.
Basically, it's like Snowfall-esque stories, and they have a mapping tool built right in. So if you're doing a story and you're writing it, you can basically take that area that you're in. So if you're in Mongolia and you're in some small town, you can create a tab in an applet that will just show where that is. So you don't even have to do any coding. But it's a really nice tool for especially American audiences who might not know where a lot of these different towns are. And so that group requires no coding whatsoever. And Creativist is really great because of what you see is what you get. So it's like WordPress. So it's pretty easy to figure out. So it's off-site, but it would be a standalone site from what you're doing. What your regular site is, but it's definitely worth checking out if you're looking
at
how to do mapping.
That's great. So we'll add those two tools to the takeaway document for you guys as well. Go.
I don't have to take
notes. Yeah, no. We'll definitely add those links. Please, yeah.
Just quick recommendation for live streaming video through one of these. I know it's possible.
Yeah.
It's not that easy, and I know it can get expensive if you scale up. Any recommendations?
Ustream, I think. Ustream, yeah. Quick, Q-I-K. I think they're free, and I think they work pretty well. My students use them usually without a
hitch. And then the last step would be getting the live stream embedded onto your site. Which can be done, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. One of the tools that is useful, particularly if you want to do any kind of live coverage, like live blogging, but bring in all these kinds of tools, is a tool called Cover It Live. And Cover It Live is a kind of a dashboard that allows you to amalgamate all kinds of things like streaming video, Twitter feeds, websites. You can embed polls and so on. It's a very versatile tool, live audio. But the other platforms would allow you to bring in live streaming as well. WordPress, I think you can, and many others. So, now whether you want to look at a live stream, I don't know, but I will tell you this, not always, but last night when I went onto the SEJ site and I noticed that they have a live stream of the main hall. And it was, 10 o'clock at night. I had just gotten in, and I looked, and there was, like, one lone figure walking along, and I felt really at home. It felt good. It was like, wow, okay, there's someone there. That's what it's going to look like tomorrow, There was nothing happening, no news, but it brought me there. And so live streaming can certainly do that. a four-hour zoning meeting, you know, maybe.
Yeah,
you know,
so there are times when it's really useful.
That's right. That's right. Depending on the audience, too. Yeah.
Going in from the National. How about other things on mapping? We're off here at SEJ. Esri, the big GIS mapping company, they've got a kind of a little free service that they do for natural disasters.
So Esri, like
E-S-R-I.
Oh, right. Oh, is there someone here from Esri?
Your disaster wasn't here. Where you can embed.
You can wrote an app and you can take that from the side. You have to have a disaster.
Well, one can only hope.
Yeah. Yeah. Seems pretty reliable.
So many to choose from. Yeah. The other thing I want to mention just in... Whoops, discourage speech making. That's a good idea. The other thing I just want to point out, and if I can now... I have so many frickin' tabs open here. There we go. Where are we? Okay. I think this is it. And the other thing is just, you know, in terms of, this is just on location, but, you know, there's some pretty obvious things when you're searching, when you're using search for location. Like, for example, with Twitter, with their advanced search, which I'll bring up if it'll accept another tab. It looks like it will. So advanced search on Twitter allows you to select a place, and then you can... you know, so if you're looking for news happening in, I misspelled Chattanooga. Let's try that again. It'll give the standard result is 15 miles within 15 miles. So if there's a you know, a rail accident, there's a spill. You know, you can take a look and see what people in that region are tweeting. You can control the range too in the search. Sorry, it's not really bringing it up, but the same is true with other other kinds of search. All this of this is in the document, but Facebook has their new social graph search. You know, if it's just at the top. You could say people I know who live in Washington D.C. and work for the federal government. But now, just recently, in the last couple of days, Facebook has started to roll out a way to search status updates for location as well. So if you can search for posts from the White House or posts from a certain location, then I don't think everybody has that yet because they're just rolling it out, but that is very powerful considering you have a billion-plus people on Facebook, that's a great research tool. One other tool I'll mention, and then it looks like there's a question in the back, is... LinkedIn. If you haven't looked at it, it's basically a professional social network. Most people use it for like job hunting and so on, but it has a very sophisticated search capability, including for location. So you can find someone who works for a company, let's say that's in the news, or someone that used to work for a company has left and maybe wants to talk about it, who lives in a particular area, you know, if it's a multinational or something. So all of these tools have search, which allow you to identify locations. It's sort of more obvious, not quite as fancy, but it's very useful as a reporting tool. I think there was a question. Was there a question back there? Otherwise, no. Okay. So please state your name.
I'm Sally Deneen. I'm a freelancer in Seattle. LinkedIn for journalists, you go there and sign up for their webinar, and you will get bumped up to a free premium account for listening to their half hour, 45-minute webinar, and plus they'll tell you these different.
Oh, I'm not logged in. Yeah. So LinkedIn for journalists, we'll add all these. I think it's, is that a Facebook? It's LinkedIn itself. There it is. Yeah, there it is. So we'll add these links as well to the document. So anybody else who's used some of these tools that just wants to share, like Carolyn did, any of their experience, any tools that we haven't mentioned that you think are worth noting?
Yeah, Joe? General thought. Any chance of making this kind of discussion an ongoing containerized thing that would be continually available to SEJ seekers?
Yeah. Well, one way we can do that is to translate the material we have on this document to either the website or some other, you know, forum like that. You mean
on the website whenever you want it?
Yeah.
but and maybe it needs to be a discussion.
To share it,
it'd be
right.
nice if it was something that could be updated, like a Google Doc or something, right?
That's
and
a
people
good
could
idea.
Keep, anybody could add to it.
Well, you know what? I mean, I could take the Google Doc that we've been using and just change it so that it can be edited by anyone. And then everybody in this room could add something. I mean, my experience is that after a while, people just forget it's there.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know. But, you know, maybe for a while it becomes useful. Certainly there are some good resources in there, courtesy of the panelists.
I understand it from National Geographic. Could that be just if this, then that? That's a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I try to use it to extract Twitter feeds and dump them into a Tumblr, but it's like the RSS feeds on Twitter were erratic, so I just had to stop doing it. But are there other uses that you guys have used?
So I would hope you guys, Dennis and Caroline, maybe can chat at the end. And I just want to say first, we're at the end. I said end time, but that's a different thing. We're at the end of the panel. Hopefully not end time. But the SEJ membership meeting is starting at 3:30 in the ballroom. So I encourage everybody to go and take part in that. But I just want to say thank you on behalf of the panelists, but also all of you. Right?